So I thought to read from the biography of Ajahn Chah and the establishing of Wat Pho Phong, and which is 1954, and sort of the early days of Wat Pho Phong and some of the recollections, and then to finish up with a contemporary a voice that showed, say, a snapshot of Ajahn Chah many years later. Okay, so they walked westwards from Bangor in the late afternoon. So Bangor was Ajahn Chah's home village, and it's about 2.5 kilometers in the front of Wat Pho Phong. They walked westwards from Bangor in the late afternoon, the cracked earth of the paddy fields on either side of the cart track soon giving way to trees, at first spindly and forlorn in the heat, and then increasingly luxuriant. Ajahn Chah and his disciples found themselves walking through welcome pools of shade. Their destination, the forest of Ba Phong, loomed densely beneath the setting sun. The monks put up their gloats at the forest's edge. As the deafening shrill of cicadas slowly ceased and darkness fell, they felt Ba Phong's presence beside them, calm and benign. It was the 8th of March, 1954. Ba Phong held Ba in Thai means forest. And Phong is actually some kind of low-lying area. Ba Phong held strong associations for Ajahn Chah. It was Ajahn Sao's short sojourn there during the 1920s that had led to his first knowledge of the wandering forest monks. Ajahn Sao was a contemporary of Ajahn Mun, and we actually have relics of Ajahn Sao on our shrine. And he always remembered being fascinated by his father's account of offering alms to the great monk at the foot of a tree, and of hearing how Ajahn Sao ate from his bowl rather than from plates, as the village monks did. Ajahn Chah recalled his father's slight puzzlement at Ajahn Sao's down-to-earth teaching style. "It wasn't like a sermon at all," he had complained. "It was just like normal talking." Many years later, Ajahn Chah related, "My father's account stayed with me in the early days when I first set off on Tudong, and coming to visit, my mind would always turn to this forest." There was a sense of inevitability about Ajahn Chah settling down in Ba Phong. Ajahn D, this is a quote, Ajahn D from Phi Bun and Lumpa Phut once passed through, and the villagers invited them to establish a monastery in the forest. They said they couldn't. Ajahn D said, "This isn't our place." Lumpa Phut still speaks of that to this day. Lumpa Phut is a disciple of, I mean, he's passed away now, but he was one of the senior disciples of both Ajahn Sao and Ajahn Mun. Lumpa Phut still speaks of that to this day. "It won't be long now," he said, "and the owner will arrive." On the morning of the 9th of March, 1954, the quote-unquote owner and his group of monks entered the seemingly impenetrable forest for the first time. Villagers from Bangor cut a path ahead of them, expertly hacking away through the stubborn vines and tangled undergrowth. Eventually, at the cool heart of the forest, they halted. The wiry villagers, sweat running down the protective spells tattooed on their chests, squatted in a circle and rolled cigarettes. Ajahn Chah sat down at the foot of an ancient and imposing mango tree. The monks drank water from their bamboo flasks and tranquility from the air around them. A group of women had been following in the monks' wake. Now they joined their menfolk in methodically removing all the vines, stumps, and thorns in the neighborhood of the old mango tree. Clearing land was work at which the villagers were adept, and a central open area soon started to take shape amongst the larger shade-bearing trees, creating a neat, stately, almost park-like atmosphere in the midst of the thick and tangled jungle. At the foot of some of the larger trees beyond the edge of this area, small squares of land were cleared for the monks to set up their gloats. Gloats are their umbrellas and mosquito nets. The monks themselves, forbidden by the vinaya to dig the earth or destroy plant life, helped by dragging off cut branches into the forest and sweeping the cleared areas. With the sun overhead filtering down between the large patches of shade in bright, hot pools, the work continued at a steady pace. By late afternoon, a rudimentary path had been cut to the edge of the forest. After taking their leave of Ajahn Chah, the villagers made their way home along the new path for the first time. In the heart of the forest, as darkness set in, the monks in their gloat sat in meditation. Some days later, a group of volunteers from Ban Gaw and Ban Glan arrived to build kutis for the monks. So the Ban Gaw is in the front of Wat Pa Pong, Ban Glan is behind the Wat Pa Pong. They brought with them sections of thin yakha thatch for the, that's a kind of a grass, thatch for the roofs and cut the main posts and beams from the trees around them. Deftly, the men split bamboo into long strips to weave into floors, while the women attached large dry chat leaves to bamboo frames for the walls. Four huts were completed by the evening, simple dwellings but sufficient for the monks' needs. The flimsiness of these shelters could not conceal their significance. Their creation, in the space of a day, had transformed the monks' presence in the forest from that of respectful guests, absorbing its peace and shade, to gentle settlers. But in the eyes of most of the local villagers, Ba Pong was not a tranquil place. The monks' new home possessed for them a daunting notoriety. Towards the northern end of Ba Pong, a now dry freshwater pool had once attracted tigers and elephants, and it was believed there was a harsh and vengeful guardian spirit in the forest, determined to protect it from human intrusions. Unusually, Ajahn Chah, generally very forthright in his opposition to superstitions, did not counter this belief. "When I first came to stay here, it was a hard place to live, and the local farmers lived a long way away. They didn't dare to come into the forest because the guardian spirit here was so fierce. The spirit was once an elephant herder who had often passed through the forest on his expeditions to capture elephants and would water them at the pond on the way back. In the end, he settled down here to look after the forest, and it's thanks to him that by the time I came to live here, there was still some of it left. Otherwise, it would probably all have been cut down long ago. There was one time some villagers from Ban Bok and Ban Pung did clear a patch of land and plant some rice and vegetables, but all of them came to an unfortunate end. People who have come in and cut down trees have tended to die from mysterious causes. Wild potatoes grow abundantly in the forest, but nobody has dared to touch them. It was only after I'd come to live here that people started to farm more closely to the forest edge." The full moon day of March marked the first Uposatha since the monks' arrival in the forest. About a dozen lay people came to spend the day and night practicing with the Sangha. At 7 o'clock, the evening chanting completed and the last light of the day fading away, Ajahn Chah began to expound the Dhamma. His voice was energetic and absorbing. As the words flowed more and more surely, he began to be illuminated by the rays of the newly risen moon. Then, quite without warning, in the full spate of his exposition, Ajahn Chah suddenly fell silent. Many of his listeners found their eyes jerked open in surprise to be greeted with the view of Ajahn Chah sitting in the moonlight, as still and composed as a Buddha image. After a few moments, he said to his audience, "Just sit calmly. If anything strange occurs, there's no need to be alarmed." And then, without further explanation, he resumed his discourse. A few minutes later, a bright light, like a comet, appeared in the sky to the northwest of the small cleared area in which they sat, passed very low above their heads, and dropped earthwards to the southeast of them. The whole forest grove was bathed in a dazzling light. Despite the forewarning, monks and laypeople were profoundly thrilled at what they considered to be an obviously auspicious portent for the new monastery. Ajahn Chah, however, paid no attention to the light whatsoever and carried on with his Dhamma talk, as if nothing had happened. Gradually, the spell and power of his exposition reasserted its hold over his audience. The following morning, when Ajahn Chah led a small group of lay people to mark with stakes the limits of the new monastery, it did not pass unnoticed that the boundaries he chose, enclosing an area of some 67 acres, were governed by the points at which the strange light had risen and fallen. Ajahn Chah, however, was never one to focus attention on the marvelous without good reason. He did not refer to the matter again. Menoy, who had been present the first time the light appeared, tells us of another Wanprat night and a strange vision. Those of us from Bangor who wanted to go and listen to the Dhamma on Wanprat nights would have to follow a narrow track through some scrub forest. Some sections of it were thickly overgrown with kha grass. One night, even though there was quite a big group of us, including Poput, one of Ajahn Chah's very close childhood friends, we got lost out by Ngungulugam Pond. Just as we were standing there, discussing which way to go, we saw a bright light hovering over the tips of the large mango tree, and we headed into the forest towards it. The undergrowth was thick with grass and tangled leaves, but we kept on struggling through it with the light as our goal. We assumed that a big hurricane lamp had been suspended in one of the trees. How kind Lumpa was to put up a light to guide us. All our weariness disappeared, but when we reached the clearing where the monks lived, there was no light at all. We were amazed. Wat Bapong was established without capital and with no plan of development. Ajahn Chah's belief was that if the Sangha practiced sincerely, the material evolution of the monastery would gradually take care of itself. Lay Buddhists, inspired by the monks' dedication, would offer the necessary funds of their own volition. In the long term, buildings would be needed, but they were not an urgent or overriding concern. The important thing was the monks' practice. The discipline forbids monks from all kinds of fundraising efforts. They are taught to be content with whatever is offered with faith, however much or however little, whether of good quality or poor. Ajahn Chah followed these injunctions scrupulously. If it was going to take 10 or 20 years to build a proper sala, a meeting hall, then so be it. He was not going to sell his integrity for bags of cement. The monks went on alms round in the morning, ate a single meal, and then spent the rest of the day at their practice. Faithful villagers provided the things they needed. Everything else they simply did without. The arrival of Ajahn Chah and his monks was a talking point in local communities for a few days. Some people maligned them as zealots. Others were deeply inspired by the forest bhikkhus and became regular supporters of the new Wat. But in general, reactions were more neutral. The cultural identity conferred by the village monasteries and the opportunities for making merit they provided were as much as most people expected or sought from religion. The presence of a great meditation master so close by was not immediately appreciated. Few people were even aware what meditation was, or that lay people could practice it. When the novelty of the forest monks had worn off, so did a large part of the interest in them. Over the years, Wat Bapong was to have a significant effect on the local scene, but the impact on the local community was cumulative rather than explosive. For a number of years, the physical conditions in which Ajahn Chah and his disciples lived were extremely austere. The gap between their standard of living and that of the people in the villages surrounding the monastery was not, however, a large one. Find in the morning, eat in the evening is a Thai idiom that well expresses the poverty of most inhabitants of rural Ubon in the mid-1950s. If the monks had little to eat with their daily ball of sticky rice and patched their robes until they fell apart, the local villagers were hardly better off. These had always been barter economies, and cash or disposable income was still in short supply. What little money people did have was kept aside for times of illness. If they had a few spare pence for merit making, their first obligation was to support their local village monastery. The material development of Wat Bapong was thus extremely slow. And yet perhaps it would be a mistake to consider it so, because slowness can suggest tardiness, or the idea that there is a standard length of time to build a monastery. Unhurried might be a better description. Wat Bapong developed in the same way as its monks paced up and down their meditation paths, one step at a time. The monks had three main robes made of thick cotton, supplemented by one or two unksas and bathing cloths. The jiwon and the sabong, if looked after and patched as they began to wear thin, could last for 3 or 4 years, and the double-layered sanggati much longer. Both robes could double as blankets at night. Bedding consisted of a rattan mat and a folding wooden pillow that the monks usually made themselves. There were no torches, and even candles and matches were hard to come by. Water for drinking and general use was drawn from a well. Their other requisites consisted of a gloat, a shoulder bag, a sitting cloth, water filter, needle, and thread. Ajahn Chah said, "When I first came to live here, we had no footwear and no matches, just flints. We'd stuff kapok into a length of bamboo, leave one end open with half a lemon skin as a lid. You'd strike the flint to get a spark and light the kapok in the tube. Then you come down from your kuti in the thick black darkness, raise your hands in Anjali above your head and say, 'Sadhu, with the power of the virtues of the Buddha, the Dhamma, and the Sangha, may all beings be happy, and please leave me alone.'" In the middle of the night, it was pitch black. You couldn't see a thing. It was easy to tread on something on your walking path without seeing it. In fact, I trod on snakes quite often. There's a lot of those small poisonous kapaya snakes around, but they never bit me. Cloth was in very short supply. When a robe became holed or ripped, its owner would be expected to patch and darn it until the cotton reached the terminal tissue paper stage of decline, at which every slight strain would tear it. Only then would the monk be issued cloth from the monastery store to make a new one. Ajahn Tiang, who had been with Ajahn Chah at Ba Tao, has spoken of those days as follows. Ba Tao was where Ajahn Chah was before coming to Wat Bapong. It was in a neighboring district. It was probably several days' walk away. It was in an area kind of north and a little bit east. There's starting to be some hills up in that area. Making a set of robes wasn't an easy thing. For the first 3 or 4 years, we sewed by hand. Sometimes after cutting a robe, the whole sangha would sit down and help with the sewing. Then it would be dyed in chakrut dye. You had to keep boiling those chips down for hours and hours. That is, if you could get hold of any cloth to dye in the first place. By the time it was finally ready to be worn, a couple months have gone by. Bowl covers we had to crochet ourselves. It was difficult. If there had been as many monks as there are these days, I don't know how we would have managed. It was difficult, but Lumpa kept it all going. In the villages of Isan, a woman's day typically begins at dawn with the cooking of the day's rice. At some time after 6 o'clock, she hears the monastery bell being rung to announce the monk's alms round. She takes a bamboo container of freshly cooked sticky rice out to the front of her house, and as she waits for the monks to arrive, she chats with her neighbors. The monks approach in single file with eyes downcast, and she places a lump of sticky rice into each monk's bowl, usually silently dedicating the merit to deceased relatives. Essentially, the alms round is for her a ritual offering of rice. It allows her to begin the day performing a virtuous deed in the company of her friends and of being reminded by the calming sight of the monks of the higher things in life. If she is a dedicated merit maker, she may take other dishes, curries, fruit, sweets, edible leaves, fermented fish, etc., known collectively as with rice, to the monastery herself, or she may help to do the daily cooking in the monastery kitchen. The custom whereby lay Buddhists go to help prepare food for the monks has done much to maintain a close daily relationship between the laity and the sangha in the Isan. It is, however, a system not well geared to the forest monks. They lived too far away from the village for all but the most dedicated to go to offer food in the morning. In the early days of Wat Bopong, the monks would usually return from the village with little more than sticky rice in the bowls. Only rarely would there be a few bananas or dried fish to augment it. Seldom would lay people follow them back and prepare food in the monastery. Fortunately, the novices were not hampered by the Vinaya rules forbidding monks from picking fruit. They would stop to pick gutin and milkwood leaves from the trees by the path on the way back to the monastery. Dipped in chili sauce, they would relieve the monotony of the heavy rice. Four nuns, Ajahn Chah's mother, Me Pim, and three other local villagers, took the precepts from Ajahn Chah in that first year, and they tended a herb garden to supplement the alms food. Meiji Bunyu remembers the hardship of those days. The food that was left over from the monks would be distributed amongst the nuns. However much that might be, there was never any left over. If the monks got nothing, then we would go without as well. We'd never try to procure food from elsewhere. Sometimes there would be an invitation for the monks to eat in a layperson's house, and there would be only be two or three monks left to go an alms round. There were 10 nuns. After we'd shared out the rice, each of us would be left with a ball the size of a lemon. So that's how much we'd eat. There was nothing to go with it, but we knew how to get by with plain rice. One time, we remember the monks came back from alms round with three bananas between them. Lumpa had one of the monks cut them into thin little slices and distribute them. That day, those three bananas fed the whole community. The hungry young bhikkhus, the daily meal consisting of a ball of sticky rice, a dab of chili sauce, and not much else, could still be wonderfully delicious. Ajahn Jan, that was one of Ajahn Chah's senior disciples. Ajahn Jan was one whose appetite was never blunted by the frugality or monotony of the food. Until the end of his life, he cherished the memory of looking up from his bowl one day to see Ajahn Chah's eyes upon him. A bolt of guilt flashed through his body as he suddenly became conscious of the relish with which he was dispatching his rice. But it subsided as soon as it had arisen. He realized that the look on Ajahn Chah's face was not disapproval. The heedless disciple was not about to be scolded for gluttony. What Ajahn Jan remembered, seeing in Ajahn Chah's expression that day, was the warm, generous smile of a father watching a ravenous son tucking in after a hard day's work in the field. Ajahn Chah said of that time, "I never sat around wasting my time trying to think up ways to get hold of this or that kind of food. As far as I was concerned, plain rice was enough to survive on. And that went for the people that had the faith to come to practice here as well. Ajahn Jan, Ajahn Tien, Ajahn Sinowan, and the rest. I'd make an announcement that today there would be a hot drink in the afternoon. And everyone would come and drink it quietly. Not coffee or cocoa or anything sweet, but Boropet. And there were no complaints about its bitterness. There was nothing else, and so that's what we drank." In later times, when lay support for the monastery had developed much more and food was more plentiful, Ajahn Chah would often recall the early hardships. He would constantly remind the bhikkhus that they had no right to be well fed. Frugality was not an austerity imposed through circumstances, but a virtue to be cultivated. As a quote, "At least we had something to eat every day, and even if it was only plain rice, it was better than nothing. Eating plain rice would make me think of dogs. In poor areas, the villagers feed their dogs with just a small lump of sticky rice once a day, nothing with it, just plain rice. And they don't die. They get by all right. And what's more, those dogs are really diligent and wakeful guards. They only have to hear the sound of leaves rustling and they start barking. When their owner takes them hunting, they run like the wind because they're so lean. Whereas the dogs who are well looked after by their masters get lazy. Anyone can walk right up to them, almost step on their head, and they still don't wake up." Throughout his life at Wat Bopong, most especially in the early years, Ajahn Chah was determined to maintain the independence of the Sangha and, as far as he could, keep the world of institutions and bureaucracy at arm's length. This included abstaining from treatment at government hospitals. Bhikkhus, he felt, had not had the advantage of Western medicine for 2,500 years, and what was good enough for the great bhikkhus of old was good enough for the Sangha of Wakpapong. The benefits of modern hospitals were one of the conveniences of lay life that were renounced on entering a monastic order. Running to the hospital with every small complaint would undermine the key virtues of patient endurance that the training aimed to cultivate. This opposition to hospitals, Ajahn Chah gradually moderated and eventually discarded. But for the first 10 years at least, it was a proud tradition. In times of illness, the monks relied on local roots and leaves. Ajahn Chah had picked up a wide knowledge of traditional medicines, traditional remedies during his years of wandering, and new treatments for most of the common ailments, fevers, digestive problems, hemorrhoids that affect monks. In the early years of Wakpapong, malaria was the greatest scourge, and virtually nobody was spared from it. Malarial fevers, which occur every 1 or 2 days, usually commencing in the afternoon, are characterized by a coldness that no amount of blankets can relieve, and accompanied by blinding headaches and nausea. If the parasite gets to the brain, it can easily result in death. Fortunately, nobody died at Wakpapong, but many, including Ajahn Chah, came perilously close. Meiji Bunyu remembers one occasion vividly. Lumpa was the first one to fall ill with malaria, and he got it very badly. He had the monks carry him down from his kuti and laid on a bamboo bed in the shade. We had no modern medicines. Lumpa wouldn't let anyone have anything to do with the hospital. He wouldn't even let anybody mention its name. So we just did our best to treat him with the herbs we had. But his skin took on a kind of greenish, discolored hue, and we knew that meant he'd reached the last stage of the illness. One day the fever was particularly severe. He would lay there for a moment and then pull himself up into a sitting posture. Then, almost immediately, he would crumple back down again. This happened time and time again. Monks, novices, nuns, and lay people, we all sat there watching in silence. All our eyes were glued on him. He sat up again. He was swaying from side to side, trying to keep himself upright. He looked about, saw the dipper of medicine. He lifted it towards his mouth unsteadily, and before his attendant could help him, tipped it all over him. He lay there drenched for a moment. Then you could see him make a great effort to gather himself. He put down the dipper, sat up straight one more time, and stayed that way. There was silence. He had entered samadhi. We were all frightened and amazed at what we saw. The next morning, he still hadn't recovered, but from then on, over a period of many days, he started to gradually improve. I don't know how it was he recovered, but as soon as he did, then everyone else started to get ill. It was like an epidemic. Monks, novices, and nuns, everyone got it badly. Malaria rarely disappears completely. It often lies dormant in the liver. Ajahn Chah was to suffer a number of relapses over the next 3 years. Ajahn Jun was one of the monks who attended on him during those times. At one time, he became seriously ill, and we took turns nursing him. On each shift, there were 2 monks. We would sit out on the veranda of his kuti and go inside every now and again to check how hot he was, or prepare food for the monks, or see if he needed anything. But he wouldn't let us massage him. He was worried that he might get attached to it. So he would lie in the room, shaking with fever, while we were sitting out on the veranda, meditating with our backs to each other. Whenever there was something to be done, we went inside. Lumpa's fever would come in the afternoons. I remember one day some people had come to see him and were waiting beneath the mafai tree, where he could sit on a raised seat we'd made for him. Lumpa's fever was very high right then. His head ached and he felt nauseous. But when we told him that he had guests, he just got up, put on his robe, and went down to welcome them as usual. After many days of constipation, he finally went to the toilet. Ajahn Chah, come and have a look at this, he called to me after he came out, and I walked over to where he was standing. He pointed to a leaf that he put on the ground. I looked down. In the middle of the leaf was what seemed like a small rock. It was a lump of excrement. That's why I've been so constipated, he said. The medicines used for malaria were prepared from borapet, a kind of vine indigenous to the Isan and notorious for its bitterness. The making of Bora infusions became one of the daily duties of the nuns. Meiji Bunyu recounts the method. You'd finely chop a piece about a foot long for each person, pound it to a mush, then strain it through a thin cloth into a glass of water. That would give you a thick liquid. Then the patient would have to hold his breath and knock it all back. The attitude to illness in those days is clearly expressed in one of Lumpa's reminiscences. The monks in those days had a lot of endurance. No matter how ill they were, they would refuse to go to the hospital. I myself had malaria for 3 years and never went. I just struggled with it here. I boiled borapet and drank it with salt or with samoas. It worked really well. It just wasn't very pleasant, that's all. It was difficult on the body, but if you haven't reached your time, you won't die. In those days, there was no medicine. If anyone got malaria, I'd encourage them. Endure it. Meditation monks must be fearless. If any of you die, I'll see to the funeral myself. If I die first, then all of you can cremate me. Don't hold on. It's suffering. That's how we talk and admonish each other. There was no discouragement or despair. The monks were really brave, courageous, capable. I had no concerns that any of them would be cowed by such things. Ajahn Chah remembers that Lumpa's treatment of sick monks was gentler than his rhetoric. Lumpa was very tough. He used to say, if you're not dead, then make it good, and if it's no good, then let it die. But at the same time, whenever one of the monks or novices became ill, he would always give them special attention and kindness. Whenever someone was too ill to come out for the meal, he would put food aside for them himself. He would go and visit them regularly at their kuti and ask how they were. If their spittoon was full, he'd take it away and wash it out. After that, he would sweep around the kuti and then inspire them with Dhamma teachings. We didn't have much in the way of medicine, only local herbs, but he gave the best that he could, encouragement in the practice. So, of course, it goes on about the conditions in those days and the daily practice and the how the training was. And so I'll just skip that. A summary and analysis of Ajahn Chah's way of teaching during this period is given by Ajahn Thiel. The first thing he told us to do was to establish a stable mindfulness, to make it continuous, not to get lost or distracted, or let it be cut off. He said his Dhamma has no top and no bottom. It wasn't short or long. He said that he had pressed it into a ball that was shaped like a coconut. He taught us to establish mindfulness, nurture our faith, incline our minds towards the triple gem of Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha. He himself had genuine reverence, and he taught that reverence to us too. He taught us to be mindful while we were bowing. He said that if we let our minds wander and our mindfulness was poor, then there would inevitably be some fault or other in what we did. When your mind is not calm, he said, when it's in a hot, agitated, abnormal state, something will always go wrong. Mindfulness was his main emphasis, making mindfulness constant and smooth, patibaddha, without interruptions, not allowing it to be broken. Whether standing, walking, sitting, or lying down, or eating, you had to be mindful, because if you lose your mindfulness, it's the same as losing your life. That's what he'd say. If there was a work project going on, for instance, and we complained that we didn't have the opportunity to practice, he would ask us if our breath stopped while we were eating or lying down. How could you be too exhausted to meditate when your breath is so immediate and ordinary? There's nothing more to it than the breath. If you practice and you're mindful, it's nothing more than being with this ordinary breath. That was all he taught. Mindfulness was the main part of it. If you lose your mindfulness, what kind of meditation technique are you going to use? What sort of concentration are you going to develop? What sort of purification is going to take place? It won't work. So it's mindfulness that is important. Coolness and tranquility arise in the presence of mindfulness. Dhamma and Vinaya, every one of the monastic regulations, arise with mindfulness. If there's no mindfulness, how can you be aware of anything? That's how we taught the principles of truth. He'd say, as monks and novices, don't be proud. Don't look down on others. Don't be attached to your family background or nationality. That's not virtuous and it's not the Dhamma. Wash your hands of those kinds of pride and aim single-mindedly to abandon all conceit and views. He told us not to make too much out of each other's faults, to keep considering how similar we all are, and not to dwell on thoughts of who's right and who's wrong. Admonishments are normal. After you've done something wrong, then put it behind you. Don't hold on to feelings of right and wrong. As soon as there's holding and attachment, it's not Dhamma and it's not Vinaya. If something is in line with the Vinaya, then it is in line with the Dhamma as well. By keeping the Vinaya, you are practicing Dhamma. Lumpa treated them as connected. He never separated Dhamma from Vinaya. He held to the principle that it was impossible for anything immoral to be Dhamma. He taught us to practice the different aspects of the path simultaneously. That's why he said his teachings weren't short or long, but pressed into a sphere like a grapefruit or a coconut. Monks who arrived in the mid-1960s, as the size of the community steadily increased, might have found a slight relaxation of Ajahn Chah's fierceness, but by no means did they have an easy time of it. To create within his disciples the will towards the training and the patient endurance that was needed for them to succeed in it, his aim was still to foster within them a whole new attitude to their lives, one in which everything matters. Nothing was done in a slipshod manner. Care, attention, and respect had to be given to every action. Relentlessly, Ajahn Chah bludgeoned the monks' heedlessness. Mindfulness was a basic need to be attended to, not a virtue to be attained. With laxness or negligence in minor matters of procedure, bringing down such wrath upon their heads, few monks could even contemplate larger, more serious infringements of the Vinaya. In most cases, a sense of shame and dread of wrongdoing, although somewhat artificially quickened, soon matured. Ajahn Anaik remembers, if anyone did something that deviated from his instructions, it would become an issue immediately. Suppose Lumpa heard the sound of buckets clanking at the well outside of the time he'd laid down for hauling water, or chopping jackfruit trips to make dye at the wrong time. That evening, we would hear about it. He would get up on the Dhamma seat and lay down the law until late at night. On some occasions, he would go on until 3 a.m. By that time, it wasn't worth going back to our kutis, and after he'd got down from the seat, we'd go straight into the morning chanting. So we would have to keep nudging and reminding each other if we saw anyone doing anything at the wrong time, because we were afraid of another dressing down. Even if there was only one miscreant, Ajahn Chah wouldn't let anyone else go back to their kutis. Everyone had to sit there and listen to the lecturing. It was no different than being told off yourself. And it was frustrating for those who were intent on meditation or had other business to see to. We monks were really afraid that we'd have to listen to a long talk. If Ajahn Chah knew someone had done something wrong, then he would never leave it overnight. He'd either call over the individual monk at fault or speak to the whole Sangha. He was always very strict and vigorous. Anyone who had any kind of business, no matter how important or trivial, would have to go and ask his permission first before seeing to it. You couldn't just go ahead and do something on your own authority. If you did, you could be sure that that evening you'd be in for a long talk. If anyone missed chanting or came 5 or 10 minutes late, it was a serious matter. As you approached the sala, you had to walk as softly and silently as possible. Making a noise was completely unacceptable. If you did, you'd get a scolding for disturbing the people already meditating in the hall. Lumpa said that making a noise close to people who were meditating was ill-mannered and bad kamma. What's more, it indicated a lack of mindfulness, self-awareness, and sense restraint. He said that for a practitioner of Dhamma, it was disgraceful behavior. Ajahn Rumlin. If you went out to urinate, you'd get a Dhamma talk. You had to endure until the end of the meeting. He'd say, "Other people can do it. Why can't you? You're a human being the same as they are. You've got all the same organs. What's so difficult?" That's how we did things in those days. Your robe would become completely soaked with sweat. You lose so much moisture that way that the ache to urinate would disappear. We were afraid of Ajahn Chah as well, really afraid, when he started getting onto us like that. You eat a lot and sleep a lot. If you eat a lot, then you have to shit a lot. Drink a lot and you have to piss a lot. I've heard those words so many times, but as a result, in our eating, our actions, we were always very moderate. In those days, there was a great care and precision in how we did things. The atmosphere at Wat Bapong was not, however, as grim and harsh as some of the preceding quotations might suggest. Ajahn Chah's exhortations were given in a semi-tropical forest in which, for months every year, stifling heat and humidity encouraged sloth and torpor. The audience was an easygoing group of young men, free of the instilled guilt and self-hatred that might have led them to take such browbeating unwisely. The heavy hand was, in short, a medicine whose benefits outweighed its side effects. Once monks had become accustomed to the novelties of the monastic life and had mastered the basic tasks and duties they tended, if their meditation practice bore no great fruits, to reach an impasse. It was difficult for them to maintain their original enthusiasm. The constant urging and upbraiding for Lumpa sought to invigorate the regular cases of slumping zeal. It might perhaps be compared to the stick employed in Zen meditation halls. For the most part, the Isan monks enjoyed the fiery talks in the same way that they relished fiercely spiced food. In fact, they would praise the more abrasive talks as, quote, really getting down to the chilies and ginger. An underlying warmth and good humor was never far below the surface at Wat Bapong. Every now and again, Ajahn Chah would invite the Sangha over to his kuti in the evening. He would have cigarettes passed around, and the monks would sit in a semicircle in the candlelight, smoking and listening to Ajahn Chah's anecdotes and stories. He would talk about the wisdom of enlightened monks, the triumphs and failures of unenlightened disciples, encounters with wild animals and ghosts, stories from the scriptures. There would be laughter and questions and shared experiences. These occasions were treasured by the monks. The warmth, companionship, and emotional support they felt as they sat there would answer needs not met in the formal meetings. This was Ajahn Chah as father rather than general. Often the monks felt that the points of Dhamma that they gleaned from the stories and anecdotes went deeper into their hearts than the teachings they received in formal discourses. The ambiguity of the monks' feelings towards Ajahn Chah became very obvious on these occasions. At the same time as fearing him almost as mice do the cat, or, in his own simile, burglars do the policeman, they loved and trusted him completely and would savor every moment of their time at his feet. The monk